Hey, y'all, and welcome back to Fostering Compassion, the podcast that bridges the gap between sending thoughts and prayers to actually providing the support that people need. I'm Tibby Starks, your radically compassionate podcast host, and I'm so happy to be back with episode 8. Before we get into the episode, if you're not already following the podcast on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, give me a follow. I'm at Fostering Compassion Pod. And share with me how you're fostering compassion out in your community by taking a picture or a video of yourself doing your thing and tagging the show. Also, if you want to highlight someone in your community, send me an email. I'm Tibby@fosteringcompassionpod.com and tell me about them. I'll give them a shout out on the podcast and even possibly have them on as a guest to talk about their impact and how we can all get involved. Finally, on the previous episode, we talked about Poverty Awareness Month, and I did spend a lot of time talking about Matthew Desmond's book, Poverty by America, but we also discussed the importance of the child tax credit, which ended in 2022, and at that time, child poverty rates doubled. So I wanted to bring to the show that there is a new bipartisan bill in Congress, and it would boost refundable child tax credits and incrementally lift the $1,600 cap on refundable credits. It would also give tax filers the option to use previous year's incomes if that enables their access to a larger benefit. By adjusting the credit structure, the plan aims to provide more substantial support to needy and multi-child families. This initiative, however, stops short of reinstating the monthly child cash payments that marked the 2021 approach to child welfare. So a little bit different, but this is great news that Congress has not completely overlooked the fact that the child tax credit made a huge difference for youth in America. Another thing I want to mention is a bill before Congress that would provide foster youth with guaranteed income. So Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and Robert Garcia of California have introduced the Guaranteed Income for Foster Youth Act. The federal legislation would provide $1,000 a month to all foster youth and youth with disabilities who were in foster care after turning 14, as well as those who left the system after 16 years of age but have not yet turned 27. All eligible youth would be automatically enrolled upon turning 18, according to an early draft of the bill. In 2022, California officials launched a $25 million guaranteed income pilot program that funds monthly payments ranging from $600 to $1,200 to a select number of low-income county residents who are aging out of foster care or are pregnant. Payments under the pilot program continued for 12 to 18 months, and its impact is under evaluation. Stockton was the first city in the nation to test the model and then study the results. So a 2021 evaluation of the experiment found that universal basic income recipients were twice as likely as those in a control group to shift their employment from part-time to full-time. Participants who received $500 a month later reported that the financial stability allowed them to pursue higher career goals, and the extra income also led to lower stress levels and improved mental health, research found. So I really wanted to bring this to the show because we spend a lot of time here talking about these issues, and it's great to see that two of the main things that we talk about on the show might actually be getting addressed. I love good news, y'all. Yay! But on this episode, I wanted to take some time to talk about nonviolence in honor of the season of nonviolence, which begins the day this episode comes out. So in this episode, we'll be exploring the effectiveness of nonviolence and what nonviolence action looks like and how we can practice nonviolence in our own lives. So stick with me because it's a really interesting topic and I learned a lot and I can't wait to share it with you. So before we get started, it's really important to understand what is nonviolence, right? When I looked it up, it kind of just said that nonviolence is the opposite of violence. So I had to go look up violence, which is the use of physical force so as to injure, abuse, damage, or destroy. So a working definition of nonviolence for this episode is the opposite of physical force so as to injure, abuse, damage, or destroy. Pretty basic, right? Maybe a little too broad. So I went to UN.org to read a little bit more and found that nonviolence is also referred to as nonviolent resistance, and it rejects the use of physical violence in order to achieve social or political change. It's described as politics of ordinary people, and this form of social struggle has been adopted by mass populations all over the world in campaigns for social justice. Interestingly, one key tenet of the theory of nonviolence is that power of rulers depends on the consent of the population, and nonviolence therefore seeks to undermine such power through withdrawal of consent or cooperation of the populace. So there are three main categories of nonviolent action, including protest and persuasion, including marches and vigils, non-cooperation, and nonviolent interventions such as blockades and occupations. Okay, all great information, but what is the season of nonviolence? Well, the season of nonviolence was created by the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi to honor Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. So it's a 64-day period running from January 30th, which is the day of Gandhi's assassination, and April 4th, which is the day of MLK Jr.'s assassination. And the point of this 64-day period is to promote peace and nonviolence in communities. And during the season, participants practice a new principle of peace and nonviolence every day. The principles are based on the teachings of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and they encourage people to act with compassion, kindness, and consideration. The goal is to inspire individuals and communities to make daily nonviolent choices and actions, which can create a culture of peace and nonviolence over time. The season has grown significantly since it started in 1998, and now 900 cities participate across 67 countries. And I'll include some links in the show notes so you all can go look into each of the 64 days and the individual themes. And under the theme for week one, it says, "Nonviolence begins with learning to be less violent and more compassionate towards ourselves. We learn by building the courage to speak and act with respect, honor, and reverence for our own being." So the theme for day one, which actually is January 31st, is courage. The reflection for day one states that courage comes from the French word for heart. Courage is the ability to do what is in your heart. Gandhi believed that nonviolence was the prerogative of the brave, and it asks, do you have the courage to be nonviolent? They also offer an affirmation for each day, and tomorrow's affirmation is, today I have the courage to live in accordance with my values, to speak from the heart, to treat people with compassion and kindness, and to nonviolently take a stand for what is just. And the daily action suggested is, it takes courage to stretch our worldview, to develop and deepen our commitment to peace. Courageous people are those who are empowered with the awareness that what they think, say, and do makes a difference. Today, start to see yourself as an agent of positive change. Have the courage to be the change you wish to see in the world. And each of the 64 days goes on like this. So February 1st, which is day two of the season of nonviolence, is smiling. And the daily action for that is, today, smile a lot. Share a sincere smile with everyone you meet. Smiling is the most basic form of peace work. Know that your smile contributes to peace. It's the greatest of all gifts. And the rest of the week follows with appreciation, caring, believing, simplicity, and education. So again, I will include some links in the show notes if you'd like to find out more about the season. I will also be recommending a few books that you might want to pick up. I recently started reading This Is an Uprising, How Nonviolent Revolt is Shaping the 21st Century. Now, I just picked this book up, so I've only gotten through the maybe first two chapters, but already in the introduction, they make excellent points. And one of the things that really stuck with me was that many of the critical advances of the last century and a half, such as the end of slavery, women's suffrage, the restriction of child labor, and implementation of workplace safety standards, and outlawing of many forms of discrimination, owe less to the legislative endgame that formalized acceptance of the cause and much more to social movements that put them on the map. Likewise, on an international level, an increase in the number of unelected leaders have ceded power, not as a result of traditional diplomacy or military maneuvering. Instead, they were ousted through the demand of unarmed mass mobilization. So we'll talk about some examples and how they prove that nonviolence is a key way to make change in our world. So one of the first things we think of when we think about nonviolent movements is the civil rights movement and probably Martin Luther King, right? And one of the specific events from that movement was the Montgomery bus boycott. The Montgomery bus boycott was a civil rights protest during which African Americans refused to ride city buses in Montgomery, Alabama to protest segregated seating. The boycott took place from December 5th, 1955 to December 20th, 1956, and is regarded as the first large-scale U.S. demonstration against segregation. And that event led to Martin Luther King Jr. emerging as a prominent leader of the American civil rights movement. Now, another nonviolent protest that we hear a lot about from the civil rights movement is the Greensboro lunch counter sit-in. This happened in 1960, and it was actually four freshmen from North Carolina Agricultural and Technical College in Greensboro who walked into the F.W. Woolworth store and quietly sat down at the lunch counter. They were refused service, but they stayed until closing. The next morning, they came with 25 more students. On the third day, 63 students joined the sit-in. On the following day, the students were joined by three white female students from the Women's College of the University of North Carolina, and by the fifth day, Woolworth had more than 300 demonstrators at the store. The next day, the company said that they were willing to negotiate, but only token changes were made. The students resumed their sit-in, the city adopted more stringent segregation policies, and 45 students were arrested and charged with trespassing. The students were enraged by this, and they launched a massive boycott of stores with segregated lunch counters. Sales dropped by a third, forcing the store owners to relent. 6 months from the very first sit-in, four freshmen returned and were served at the Woolworth's lunch counter. Within a year, similar peaceful demonstrations took place in over 100 cities, north and south. So yeah, obviously these were nonviolent acts, and they made a huge difference. And although sometimes we feel like we can't make change, we have to look back at these events for what they show us and remember that these were just regular people, and our laws and our rights that we have today are hugely credited to those folks who risked their lives and their freedom. Now, a story that you might be a little less familiar with, depending on how good you are at your American history, actually took place in Flint, Michigan. It's a sit-down strike that took place in 1935. At the time, the average auto worker took home about $900. What was amazing to me is that the U.S. government determined that the annual monthly income of $1,600 was the minimum on which a family of four could live in 1935. Once called the strike herd around the world, the first major labor dispute in the U.S. auto industry ended after General Motors signed a contract with the United Auto Workers Union in February of 1937. This reminded me of the summer of 2023, last year, where we had hot strike summer, including the United Auto Workers Union, the UAW, protesting for increase in wages. So when I read this story about 1935, the workers not making enough money to even have the basic standard of living, it was amazing how history repeats itself. And we cannot forget that unions are why we have things like weekends and Labor Day. And we have to support unions and respect their place in history, because they represent, like I said last week, they represent the rest of us. Corporations have so much more money than any of us individually. And so they've taken so much power in this country that if we don't act collectively in unions or, like we're talking today, nonviolent protests and organizing, then what hope do we even have? How are we supposed to fight back when our government is giving corporate companies personhood and they have the ability to donate to candidate elections and influence our elections in a way that we could never support our own candidate, right? And they have the right to refuse to comply with federal mandates. So again, unions and peaceful organizing are a huge piece of ensuring that we protect our rights. So the auto workers' strike in Flint in 1935 was the first major victory for unionization in America's history, and its consequences were dramatic. Within 2 weeks, 87 sit-down strikes started in Detroit alone. Packard, Goodyear, and Goodrich announced immediate wage increases. Within a year, membership of the United Auto Workers grew from 30,000 to 500,000, and wages for auto workers increased by as much as 300%. This strike marked the beginning of a decade of intense union activity. So what we see is that blue-collar workers, individuals, are getting pay raises only when they band together, right? So as I mentioned, we had a big UAW strike over the summer. And in case you aren't following that as closely as maybe some of us living in the Midwest, Sean Fain, the president, who I find extremely impressive and active, the union, with his leadership, won 11% wage increase for the first year and a total of 25% increase in wages over 4.5 years, a $5,000 ratification bonus, and a cost of living adjustment. When including cost of living adjustments, total pay could be raised by 30%. 3 days later, on October 28th, the UAW announced a similar tentative deal with Stellantis. And the same day, 4,000 workers at GM Spring Hill Manufacturing subsequently joined the strike, despite late-night talks on October 27th, at which Fain and General Motors CEO Mary Barra were reportedly present. On October 30th, the UAW announced a deal with General Motors, leading to a suspension of the strike and return of all striking workers back to the job. All three contracts also eliminated the two-tier system of wages, wherein some workers were classified as temporary workers and paid less. And again, in this case, I followed it closely, and the CEOs, like Mary Barra mentioned in this, who were mentioned in the story, were getting incredible increases in pay, making millions of dollars. Meanwhile, the people actually building the cars in the factories are struggling to make ends meet. And as we've talked about in basically all of the episodes, the cost of housing in this country has increased in my lifetime 300%. So when regular blue collar workers in Michigan and Ohio aren't making enough to even pay rent in the Midwest, and people like Barra are sitting high on their horse, making millions of dollars and having multiple homes, it just, how's that American? How is she working any harder than all of those people inside the factory every day? It's just asinine. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention women's suffrage, because leading up to the 19th Amendment in 1920, women used aggressive tactics. They were relentless. They used publicity stunts and civil disobedience and nonviolent confrontation to win attention for their cause. Their willingness to be arrested for their cause was notable, and they were recognized for being political prisoners rather than criminals. Even after being arrested, they continued civil disobedience inside jail, and their constant agitation effectively compelled President Wilson to support a federal women's suffrage amendment. So another issue that has leveraged nonviolence in fighting for change has been the LGBTQ movement. And in the 80s and 90s, we know that the AIDS epidemic created an additional burden on the community. And in March of 1986, William F. Buckley Jr. wrote in a syndicated column, Everyone detected with AIDS should be tattooed in the upper forearm to protect common needle users and on the buttocks to prevent victimization of homosexuals. That same year, by a vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court upheld a Georgia sodomy statute in a case involving two men having sex in a private home. Several years into a harrowing epidemic, gay Americans were told that an act of consensual sex could not only infect them with a fatal disease, it could also, at the will of the state, send them to prison. The fears of internment were not easily dismissed as hysteria. So in 1987, a group called ACT UP, or AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, was founded. As we know, tens of thousands of Americans, mostly gay men, had died of AIDS, and more were dying every day, even as the government remained indifferent. Something I read that really brought it home for me was a statement: a despised group of people with no rights, facing a terminal disease for which there are no treatments, abandoned by their families, government, and society. And what that really brought home for me was that if a group of people facing terminal disease without any form of treatment, and they're abandoned by their family, their government, and their society, and if they can make change using nonviolence, I think that says a lot. The ACT UP members lived by a creed set out by Ann Northrup. Actions are always, always, always planned to be dramatic enough to capture public attention. So they did things like they wrapped the home of North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms in a giant yellow condom. They invaded St. Patrick's Cathedral during Mass. They protested the FDA, and they dumped the ashes of comrades who had died of AIDS on the White House lawn. Now, although ACT UP is remembered for its extreme measures, it never committed an act of violence, despite enduring many. Now, again, what this shows us is that a few committed activists can make a big difference. So when it comes to things like racial justice and universal health care, we just have to organize. Other movements of note are obviously the Black Lives Matter movement, and what we saw in 2020, summer of 2020, after the death of George Floyd in May, are both examples of mass demonstration, mostly peaceful demonstration, demanding racial justice and equality. Additionally, March for Our Lives, which was founded after the Parkland, Florida shooting at a high school. Amazingly, in 2011, we saw the Arab Spring, which preceded a Tunisian vegetable vendor who set himself aflame to protest police harassment. And what's amazing about that is that by late 2011, the Middle East had changed as a region, and new governments were being negotiated in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, Yemen. Now, obviously, we're seeing huge issues and flare-ups now after Hamas's October 7th attack on Israelis. But since then, Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, has used that as an excuse to commit genocide on the people, mostly children, of Palestine. So if you want to use this season of nonviolence as an opportunity to fight for peace in the Middle East, you might consider going to the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, or uscpr.org, and taking action. They have a variety of ways for you to do so, and I'll add a link to the show notes. If you're curious about uprisings and protests, you can go to the Carnegie Global Protest Tracker. I'll share that in the show notes as well. It's a great tool that organizes every protest in the world by country, size, event, all kinds of different criteria for you to search by. But because I am a recovering academic and I can't skip out on some good research, I wanted to mention Erica Chenoweth, who is actually a native Ohioan, but now she is a professor and I believe a dean at Harvard. And I stumbled on a TED Talk that she did many years back, but still relevant. And she actually did a study of all uprisings in the entire world between 1900 and 2006. And she brings some really interesting data from that research, which might challenge your thinking. She found that it only takes 3.5% of a country's population to engage in nonviolent resistance to enact change. Nonviolent campaigns worldwide were 2 times as likely to succeed as violent insurgencies. She also found that increasing over time for the last 50 years, nonviolent campaigns have become more successful and common, while violent insurgencies are becoming increasingly rare and unsuccessful. She found that nonviolent campaigns were 4 times larger and more inclusive and representative, and nonviolent struggles were more likely to result in democratic institutions and 15% less likely to relapse into civil war. So if you want to check out that TED Talk by Erica Chenoweth, I will definitely share it in the show notes because it's worth a watch. Now, if you want help coming up with creative ideas for taking action during the 64-day season of nonviolence, you might consider checking out the Albert Einstein Institution at aeinstein.org. They have a list of 198 nonviolent actions, and I can share that in the show notes as well. So these 198 nonviolent actions are classified into 3 categories, including nonviolent protest and persuasion, non-cooperation, and nonviolent intervention. Additionally, if you're looking for some great reading, I mentioned Erica Chenoweth, but she also has a book called Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. I would suggest picking that up. I haven't read it yet, but I ordered it. Again, I will mention This Is an Uprising, How Nonviolent Revolt is Shaping the 21st Century by Mark Engler and Paul Engler, which I just started reading, so I will report back, but so far so good. And finally, The Force of Nonviolence, The Ethical in the Political by Judith Butler. Just a few books, there are plenty of lists out there, but those might get you started. So don't forget, tomorrow we start the season of nonviolence with courage. Don't forget to go to the link that I will provide in the show notes to check out more about the season of nonviolence, or you can just Google it. Maybe make a plan for yourself, maybe engage in the whole thing, or maybe just pick a few themes that resonate with you. But definitely don't let that 64-day period slide by without honoring it. And if you need some help with creative ideas, don't forget that we've got the 198 nonviolent ways to advocate for change. Now, next week, we'll continue our conversation about the season of nonviolence, and we'll talk about next week's themes, but we will be moving on to Black History Month. So please tune in next Tuesday to find out more. Now, if you want to support the show, in addition to tuning back in, please leave me a review. If you have feedback for me, or you'd like to be on the show, or any kind of suggestions for me, please email me. I'm Tibby@fosteringcompassionpod.com, or you can go to my website, fosteringcompassionpod.com, and there's actually a button to leave me a voicemail if that's just easier for you. Please don't forget to follow Fostering Compassion Pod on social media. And finally, as I always say, be kind to each other, y'all.